It's a pleasure to be here. As some of you know, I've been working on a book tentatively called Geontologies, A Requiem to Late Liberalism. At the heart of the book is an exploration of an indigenous transmedia project. The project is easy enough to describe. My very old indigenous friends and I hope to geotag media files about their country to play proximate to the site to which those files refer. The files, the media files, would be given a longitudinal and latitudinal coordinate and then activated with a GPS signal. We often describe this project to donors as a living library. The setting for our project is a vast, pristine coastal and wetland region in the Anson Bay of Australia. And in particular, today I'm going to focus on a little creek called Chunganana, which is right here. The project is organized through the Cotabang Indigenous Corporation. There are three things you need to know about this to see what I'm going to do today. The first is that the Cotabang Indigenous Corporation is a legal organization. It's based on law. The second thing to know is that anthropologists would describe the Cotabang as a horde rather than a clan. A clan in the anthropological imaginary is composed of patrilineal descendants of a common ancestor stretching back to a mythological period in which humans were some other form, such as here, a fish, a muddy, or a yam, moromoro. A horde refers to the actual group of people who live, cooperate, and work together. The final thing to know is that Cotabang is not a place, but rather an ecological condition. Cotabang means tied out. So that would be the horde, and Cotabang means tied out. The project that we're engaged in has a very specific goal. The Cotabang hope that a digital media project organized outside of the dominant anthropological imaginary will support their geontology, even as it provides a way of engaging their children in the land and in their way of thinking about land and people as it generates income. So it's also a market idea. Now, when I say geontology, I'm not referring to cultural traditions relating to nature. In fact, culture and nature do not appear in my talk, nor do they ever appear in when I give a talk about what we're doing or when I talk about anthropology in general. Instead, I'm going to talk about an analysis that friends of mine have done in which they're analyzing the relationship between biography and geography or geography within the actual worlds of liberalism in which they have lived. Now, with its focus on digital media and the earth sciences, this project would seem to have a self-evident relationship to the literature in critical media and science and technology studies. And with, in some ways, with the broad concept of the Anthropocene as a project rather than a science. And here, I think Akhil's point is quite good. But what I think the Cotabang Living Library illuminates first is what happens to theories of what we call immanent ontology, which I'll talk about in a second. That is the groundwork of some of contemporary theory's most fundamental categories. When these theories go into the world, when indeed what's called immanent critique occupies the world that it claims is its own ground. And this is what I want to talk about a little bit today. The capacitation, that is, if all of this conference so far has been about how do we imagine new forms of human land or human earth, some people have said culture and natural relations. The capacitation of these alternative, what I call geontologies, these geos ontologies, occurs always within a context, within a concrete world, a world in which I've been thinking in terms of late liberalism and increasingly the late liberal Anthropocene. So what I'm going to do today is I'm going to talk about what happens when immanent critique goes into the world, how I think we have to, when we want to think about the emergence of new kinds of imaginaries of the earth and humans in the earth in relation to earth. I want to talk about really kind of methodologically and theoretically what we have to have on the table. And I'm going to do so through three women. One, Chipel. Now, everybody always, when I say, one, this is the first woman, everybody looks on the beach trying to find the woman. It's not, there's no woman on the beach there. That is the woman, okay? See the woman, the legs? All right? That's her breasts here, and she's holding two spear slips, okay? So the first is Chipel. The second woman is Cecilia Yerowin Lewis, who I've known since she was 8. And the third woman is Julia Gillard, who's the prime minister, current prime minister still, of Australia. These, of course, are figures rather than agents in the very technical sense. That is, they figure for, I think, hopefully they'll figure for you the kinds of problems we grapple with if we're really trying to think of how to capacitate new forms of social imaginary. But before I get into thinking about these women, I want to begin with some general comments about theories of immanent ontology. And I apologize if some of this you just think, can't we just speed past this? But I think it's important what I want to do. So, here, yes. That's actually how they're related. I told people, I always think my slides really help you. We'll see. Okay. Three things about immanent ontology that I think it's important to know when I turn to these three women. The first has to do with the politics and ethics of endurance. When immanent ontologies occupy the world they say are their grounds, and that's because immanent ontologies argues that to be simple about it, history unfolds not vis-a-vis some transcendental essence, but vis-a-vis that which is in the world, and I'll talk about it a little more. But when immanent ontologies occupy the worlds they say are their grounds, then my claim is that endurance becomes the necessary ethical and political problem we face. And this is extraordinarily important when we think about the emergence of new social imaginaries. The question of endurance is the question. Now, I could stand here for a decade and still not have unpacked the critical literatures condensed in the phrase immanent ontology, let alone why I think that endurance becomes its necessary ethical and political concern. So let me given the time constraints, let me just sketch out a few points that I think are key to understanding the problem of endurance that we face, especially when we're thinking in terms of the Anthropocene. Where better than to start than with Michel Foucault, who argued in his late lectures that we should understand truth as a kind of activity, a type of speech that breaks and characterizes the surface of a present reality, often for Michel Foucault in the form of a question or a refusal. For Foucault, this kind of speech defined freedom as being otherwise to an actual world, rather than being liberated from that world. Of course, the focus, this focus on the otherwise versus liberation has animated a lot of very important critical theorists, including our friend Deleuze, and Deleuze's interest in the question of the event and his infatuation with monsters and monstrosity. For Deleuze, for Foucault, for a lot of immanent critics, the point isn't to find the essence of a thing, but to probe the possible existence of another thing. This probing demanded a new relationship, not merely to the other, that is, and it's the reason I don't use the word culture, because culture suggests the other is there, right? It's bounded, we can put it on our desk, we can look at it, Right. But rather to the otherwise. How do these new social imaginaries break the surface? In other words, liberating the world from a transcendental ruler, from the question of essences, so as to produce new freedoms or existences, demands that we become at ease with the monstrous. And this is one of their major points. With monstrosities, with the queer, and queerness as a practice of existence. The priority of the event over the fact immediately, and this becomes very interesting, of course, when we're thinking science and science of facts versus critical theory and critical theory's interest in existence. The priority of the event over the fact immediately raises the question of the likely conditions of the event, or the monstrous. Why do they occur? And that's what we've been asking. How can we make these new imaginaries around the Anthropocenean project emerge? What allows an event or a monstrosity to become the event or the monstrosity or a event or a monstrosity? What puts something that is taking place, and this is Althusser, taking place in the world, what makes something that's taking place take hold? After all, an infinity of possible events and existences lie within any actual arrangement. You know, and it's a simple, I mean, to be simplistic about it, if I hold this, it could drop. But it could also float. Probably not. Immanent Critique, then, has asked not only what activates an event, what makes an event happen, but also of all the possible events that are occurring everywhere, why does one event more decisively rupture the current organization of the actual? And this concept of the Anthropocene is an event, right? So what allowed it to emerge and become dominant? If we don't think there's something essentially true and it's a fact. Note that, again, that truth is not measured by its propositional constancy or logic for these folks, but by the affectivity of its monstrous incomprehensibility. The more monstrous, for Immanent Critique, the more monstrous a thing, the more eventful, the more it has the capacity to be an event. And thus, the more true it is, because true is event. It's for this reason that Agamben argues that a new political thought will only come through the intensifications of certain kinds of divisions. So, for instance, if we take our transmedia project and the kind of alternative geontology I'm going to talk about that's in it, then for it to become an event, it's got to break the actuality of late liberal and emergent Anthropocenean forms of social imaginary. But if this way of thinking about freedom as an event that creates a possibility of existences is a practice by which things in the world, whether they're the self or the other, or culture and nature as given, as organized in the present, for a practice to become otherwise, then the freer, and this is what these guys say, the freer the becoming, the existence, becoming an existence, the higher the phenomenological risk for that emergent being. Put another way, the purer the event, the more existential the risk for that thing trying to emerge. Foucault was quite clear about this. He described actual events as nearly suicidal. Deleuze equally saw what he called the pure event as, quote, unrealizable and unlivable. What surprised them that the trope of choice within a lot of critics now, a lot of theoretical critics, is the trope of askesis, that is, the exercise of the self, right? How do you constitute the body to be strong enough to withstand this movement from it into and through the actual, when you are that monster? Okay, second point. Extinguishment is internal to potentiation. So if endurance, and what I'm saying is if endurance, the problem, how do you endure if you're the monster? Right? You're the new social imaginary that the Anthropocene is pulling into, that we want. But when you initially are this thing, or whatever it is, it will always appear as a monstrosity. So if endurance is the unthought of this philosophy of the event, then extinguishment is the unthought of immanent critique's emphasis on freedom as potentiation and its complex reaction to metaphysics of presence and finitude. And by that I mean something fairly simple, that immanent critique has constantly foregrounded the issue of potentiation, of existence. Right? There's plenitude, there's potentiation all around us. Now, it's certainly the case that a lot of critics, and including, we can talk about this, have thought about both immanence, potentiation, and its governance. But I think part of what's at stake here when we start thinking about how do we think about the human as something other than it is? How do we use the Anthropocenean project to develop new social imaginaries? We have to think not only how are they going to endure in the movement into the actual, but also the fact that every form of emergence is coupled with a form of extinction, of extinguishment. It's only a liberal, I would argue, it's only a liberal imaginary that says that we can just pluralize everything. Right? We'll just make more room for this new imaginary. Part and parcel of what's at stake, I think, in the Anthropocenean imaginary is that, no, something has to be extinguished. And it could be a way of life or a form of life, but the cost of something emerging is something being extinguished. Third, here I arrive at the most preliminary of my thoughts and really where this the Anthropocenean project is very productive, at least for me a little bit. The place where event, that is the emergence of these new forms of life, and extinguish it, the place in which event and extinguishment meet life, I should say. Now, if we think about being and life and the carbon imaginary, we know a set of critical problems joins at least three of these concepts. Being, life, and carbon. And we know, you know, if you even know a little bit about Western philosophy, there's often a distinction made between life and being. You know, for instance, that Heidegger shifted from his early work on life into his work on being. And we know that in critical theory, post-Foucault's writing on the history of sexuality, that there has been a lot of weight pressed on the concept of biopolitics and biopower. And in particular, the relationship between life, biopower, and the Heideggerian imaginary. But no matter how we approach the question of life, whether we approach it through this concept of zoe and bios, which is, for those of you who know Agamben, between bare life and proper life, the life proper to, whether we think about it as life proper to a form of life or there's life outside of a form of life, whatever. One of the things that the Anthropocenean project puts squarely on the table is that we need a way of intruding in this imaginary of life, that is intruding between bios and zoe with the concept of, with the concept of geos. I don't know which way I'm going now. Life, bios, finitude. Okay, no, I don't know where geos is. Geos, G-E-O-S. That is, we have to start thinking, is there a way of thinking about life or being vis-a-vis the concept of the geos or the geotic, which sounds kind of idiotic, but let's not worry too much yet. To be sure, the concept of the Anthropocene is hardly singular in its doxa. We've already heard a lot of different ways of approaching it. There's, one and the same time, I think, in the Anthropocene, we see both a challenge and a conservation of the definition of life. That is, the Anthropocene seems to, in a radicalized form, both challenge, but also in its perhaps more dominant form, conserve a definition of life vis-a-vis this imaginary of a metabolic rate. Also in the great hysteria over human life, The Anthropocene reinstates the idea that the capacity to grow, to reproduce, to have functional activity, and to change continually and die. And this finitude is such a foundational anxiety, this philosophy. That these capacities lie at the very foundation of the definition of life, and thus is what grips our political and organizes our ethical imaginary. Also, in its way, and I think this is conserved in the Anthropocene, I think the Anthropocene also reinstates a transcendental totality in the figure of the planetary, with its reference to the singularity and totality of Earth, and of man as a certain kind of, or human as a certain kind of transcendental cosmopolitical referent. But if we radicalize the Anthropocene as a project versus a science, the question of whether the planet has or has something like a metabolism potentially destabilizes the distinction between the animate and the inanimate, and with this destabilization, potentially, if radicalized, destabilizes the division between the organic and the inorganic, the carbon and the mineral, and any concept of agency and subjectivity that emerged from these distinctions. Thus, this radicalized Anthropocene potentially drives us beyond the recent post-human turn that we've talked about a little bit in the last panel, right, in which we understand man is also an animal, man is not outside in, nature, man is in nature, but rather turns us to trying to, if not, and you're going to see, I'm not interested in imagining, I'm interested in how do you pull into being different ways of making radically singular this form of life, this carbon-based understanding of bios and zoe. So those are three problems, and I just want to think of them through three women. Now maybe you'll see why Chipel is important, this Creek. So I'm going to think of through Chipel, Gigi is Cecilia Lewis, and Julia Gillard, who's the Prime Minister of Australia, who are themselves, of course, essences. They are themselves events, and that's what I want to talk about. How do they endure? Can they endure the becoming an existence? Okay, so let's start with Chipel. Who is Chipel, or what is she? Chipel is a young girl. That's what Chipel means, Chipel. In Emiangle, an indigenous language of the area that no, in an area that no longer, it's a language that no one actually speaks as a first language or really even as a second language anymore. In Emiangle, Chipel means young girl. Chipel means breast up. Chipel means post-pubescent, just barely, i.e. Chipel means desirable. Chipel lived at Jeremalong, a place down the coast with her family. One day she dressed up as a man, and there's things that she put on that we know about, and she went hunting. She speared a wallaby, and then she kept going. A wallaby is a kangaroo. She kept going. When she got to Chungamuru, a bird told her an old man was coming. Old men are not desirable. Okay. So she dug two holes in the sand to hide her breasts, and she lay belly down. When the old man saw her, he thought she was a boy. He asked her to get up and cook the wallaby. She said that he had a severe stomach ache. They argued back and forth until she told him, just you take the wallaby and I'll catch up later. So he left. But as he's walking, a bird said to him, that was no boy. So he goes back and he fucks her. Well, it should be they fight, he wins, he fucks her. I don't know why I put it out of order. Okay. Very important. Then he goes off and then she goes off. But she stayed there, right? And she's still there. So Chipel is a young girl who is a Creek with various parts of this encounter with this old man scattered around her and with other kinds of things that are like this nearby. So she had a fighting stick that's Those two right here, it's not a fighting stick. Sorry, the fighting stick's down a ways. These are spear throwers right there. They're, you would say they were coral reefs. But cheapo means something very different when we dislodge it from the grip of semantic sense and propositional-based narrative. What cheapo means is what she is becoming in a set of historical relations. Let me mention the most obvious ones. For many Karabing, cheapo is a way of loving the deceased Roy and Ruby Yerwin, a way of remaining with them in their absence. That is, cheapo, as a form of desire, is literally bioforming the subjectivity of the Karabing. Ruby was the mother or grandmother of many of the key Karabing. She was born in the region that I showed you, and which was widely depopulated from the violences and the desires of settler colonialism. The North in Australia was settled quite late for colonialism. It was settled in the mid-19th century. So when I said earlier that our media project, this transmedia project, is located in pristine coastal wetlands, these wetlands and these beaches became pristine through the violences that occurred in the last half of the 19th century. This was created as a pristine nature. Ruby was fluent in five languages and funny. She constantly regaled all of us with stories that never quite sorted themselves into classic divisions of history and anthropology. So, you know, when I became an anthropologist after being there for a while, I collected the stories. There was a young girl, she dressed up as a man, she was raped by another man, the story's true, Ruby would show us one day. And so Ruby remains both in our desire as a thing that motivates the Karabing, but also she exists as analog archive, and she exists as digitalized versions in numerous hard drives scattered around my offices. But cheapo is also the way that late liberalism governs indigenous subjects through the politics of cultural recognition and cultural denunciation. That is, cheapo is also an effect of power and its specific forms in liberal states. Since 1976, the state in Australia has territorialized indigenous ownership of land, and this goes back to clan and hoard, through the concept of the patrilineal clan, that is, descending through your father and goes back to the mythological time, like cheapo, right? And do you believe this? Yes, I do. Oh, you're real. Like that. Traditional Aboriginal owners is a nomenclature of law defined as a descent group organized through a father's line who own a segment of land with clear borders and who have a totemic ancestor located on the land, like cheapo. And these people have primary spiritual responsibility. So all, you know, it's like, oh, yeah, look, culture, right? And over time, the concept of a traditional owner has dispersed across other state agencies and into the public imaginary, so that in Australia now, you just say TO for traditional owner. It's just like, who's the TO here? And the function of these things, these bureaucracies that started in the 1970s, these things called Aboriginal land councils, over time, from the 70s to the present, shifted from claiming land on behalf of TOs to generating capital on behalf of these owners under the nomenclature of liberal law and recognition. So, for instance, cheapo marks a legal border. Oh, and you also have to be homogeneous. This is what also culture, right? We all the same. Anyone will do. So cheapo is important because cheapo also marks is a legal existence, a legal relation. She marks a legal border. And insofar she does, she provides a pathway for public affect and market capital, right? You can say, wow, this is like another way of being in the world. Cool. I feel cool. And it also can generate capital. For instance, we first saw cheapo in the world. We had seen her, we had heard about her, and I'll talk about visualization in a sec. Well, I'll talk about it in one sec. But we first saw her, like, face-to-face, I suppose you'd say, when we were in a helicopter in August doing some mining clearance, this Kadabing and I, doing some mining clearance for the Northern Land Council. And here we see that Chipel is also an effective technique of visualization. That is, if we want to put Chipel in our augmented reality project, in our transmedia project, in which you'd take a media file and you put it on the phone and use GPS, and it would only be activated when you're standing there, and then you would see Chipel, like, doing her thing while you were at Chipel. We see that Chipel, as an existence, is internal to an effect of various forms and techniques of visualization. The quotidian technique of mental mapping that a lot of the Kadabing were taught, and I was also taught, and taught by older relatives like Ruby, who we continue to do because we love Ruby and therefore want to artifactually make Chipel exist, was to stand in the place. So here's here's Chipel down here, right? And you'll see a lot of people, when this became pristine, everybody moved up the coast here, and this is 300 kilometers. The idea is, like, if we're sitting at Bellion, we stand at the community, there's community here. Sit there, stand where you are, they would say. Look in your mind what direction you were moving when you were where you were. Did you move left? Did you move? Where were you facing? You're facing Milik, which is a place. Then when you went there, where did you face? Were you facing that way? And so they said, just make it in your mind. Okay. What does the pattern look like? It looks like that, right? Do it in your brain. Now take that pattern and place it in the world. See that woman? They would say. You say, I don't see anything. And they'd yell at you. That is, visualization was a practice of the body's movement inserted into memory, and that in turn was used to materially fashion bodies, both human ones that walked around, but in walking around, say, Chipel's borders, water borders, contoured Chipel. Right? It made her crisp and clean, even as it produced a motivated human orientation to her. But the GIS technologies that we would use for our transmedia project operate through a very different visual technique. They assign a number to every possible surface of the Earth, and with these numerical values existing independent of anything we do on the Earth, whether we go around Chipel or not. In other words, the precision of these cartographic lines produces at once and the same time a hyper-historiography and an anti-historiography. As such, they've been instrumental to a vast historical... A vast historical network of militarized surveillance systems. A geological science that demonstrates the interaction of human and non-human activities on the atmospheric and geological formation. So this is what GIS has let us do. We have the military. We have the geological sciences that show us that there's climate change. So when we saw the other night those vast ice cores, right, allows us to map and see temperature changes over time. And they articulate this GIS... articulates the military and the climatic. So increasingly, here we go, you have to have satellites. Satellites were set up by the military, U.S. military, and increasingly the U.S. military are coordinating two forms of security. One, climatic security, and two, state U.S. military security. So, Chipel is all these things. And yet we can ask ourselves, is she a being, B-E-I-N-G? Is she a form of life? And can she hold her own against the demands of contemporary human forms of life, what I've been calling late liberal life? Can anyone's obligation to her, for instance, outweigh their obligations to other humans? The tide ebbs in and out of her. She touches creek bottom and sides and lounges under a hot sun and withstands hurricanes. Winds brush over her skin, and the soft sands of the dead wallaby that lie beside her ripple. She sprays herself on us as we boat across her or wade into her creek to get a crab. But she is not life if life is defined through a carbon-based imaginary, or for that matter, any other understanding of life that has at its core the prerequisite of biological reproduction and finitude. In the carbon imaginary, Chipel is mineral at the core, I think. She's geotic. She's not biotic. She's the container of life rather than life itself. As such, she can become a mine that can be exhausted, but not killed. We can exhaust her, but we can't kill her. She wasn't there to kill. Still, her extinguishment, which is, I think, different than finitude, her extinguishment does organize an entire set of relations. She provides a measure of the erosions of climate change if we stick measuring poles in her, of species shift, of tidal surges, of coral collapse, and the potential, and potentially the erosions of obligation to her as a form of existence. Not only that, but Chipel may, given one scenario, what happens to her, may give us a glimpse of our future life, of Earth as the container of nothing, of non-life. So this was Mars, you know, was there life on Mars, right? And these are arsenic books. Do we then have a theory of being if we really want to think about what kinds of existences could emerge from the Anthropocenean project? Do we have a theory of being in which the form of life that Chipel represents can be given a dwelling? And what will her being be if she is an entity, if she's not even there anymore, if she's an entity that is dispersed across the wetlands, or if the tides change and the beach and the coral erode, redistribute her and break up her parts? Now, as these questions pile up, we begin to see, I think, how Chipel provides the space for an imminent way of thinking about these new social imaginaries, perhaps a alternative to late liberal forms of the Anthropocene. And indeed, I think there's a lot of reasons a lot of people have turned to the new animism, the new totemism, the new vitalism, all of these ways of thinking critical theory that are trying to take something like animist or totemic or looking at mineral as liveliness, right? But if we really want to think, okay, fine, here's Chipel. She exists, but can she be in existence? Can she endure the transition? Can she endure the conditions of her being? Then I think we have to turn to two other women on whom she relies. The first being, I want us to see how thickly the new animism invades our aestheticism. And this is supposed to be in sound. Anyways, it goes like this. Wah, 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 wah. Oh, there it is. Right. Okay. Right. Animism and totemism has an aesthetic, so we have to break not only through a thought, we have to break through an aesthetics. Right? And it's still going, I suppose. Okay. Part of the relation that Chipel relies on is another person, and that person is Gigi. Gigi is a part of a core group that composes Karabing. She's the grandchild of Roy and Ruby Yerwin. Ruby worked to pull her out of the machinery of social welfare when she and her little sister were girls. And now Chipel relies on Gigi to pull her out of being into existence, which may in turn well depend on whether Gigi, this one here, can put into practice an analytics of survival she learned from her grandparents. And again, I'm not using culture. I'm using analytics. And I think it's really important. This, she's not trying to continue the traditions. She's trying to see whether an analytics, which I'm going to talk about, an analytics that her grandparents had, work in the world. At the core of this analytics of her grandparents and extended was a theory of the interpenetration of biographic and geographic substance, of their composition, and of the way in which substance and composition create obligation. This thing's going to go fast. There it goes. Okay. Remember, Anson Bay, this area in which the project would happen, became pristine. That is, all these little dots here were just, let's say, people or groups. And in the mid-19th century through the mid-20th century, through violence, desires, they moved. And they moved up to a place called Belyun. And that's Belyun back in the 1950s. It was an internment camp. Now, so what's at stake here, and it's not too complicated. The question that these older folks face was, how do they turn the dislocations of violent colonialism into forms of belonging, right? So settler colonialism, horrific, they move, and now they're in a place in which they don't belong. So what do they do? What this older generation did was to attempt to see, and it was a test, it was an analysis, could their ideas about substance, composition, and obligation work in this new world of settler colonialism? So, to run very quickly, the first thing to know is that for them, substance is produced by various kinds of activities. These are activities. Like I say, I think this helps, but I don't know. Hunting, ritual, birthing, burying. Each one of those was an activity. Right. And each kind of activity had its own archetypical kind of rhetoric and forms of intensity and intensification. So they're not all the same thing at all. But what they put under analytic pressure, these older people in the 50s through the 70s, was whether or not in the severe disruptions of the settlement period, these substances that came out of practices could recompose geography and thus biography. Could these substances terraform or geoform on the one hand and bioform on the other? Men and women theorized that the various bodily substances sunk into and became the compost out of which other substances grow or eaten and return. And they are. I mean, I have to say, well, this is just true if I think anything is true. Buried or burned bodies re-enter this cycle and re-emerge in specific locations. Thus, over time, this activity of, you know, honestly, shitting, peeing, sweating, talking, right, compose space. They create the here and the there and its limits. The interpenetration of bio and geography vis-a-vis substance that is composed a human world as a social geography. The more persons moved around the same place, this movement etched into the earth, and the ends of that movement produced people from it. And not only did it produce people from it, and this was what was really critical for this older generation, in being produced out of it and putting into it, it constituted mutual obligation between the forms that it sunk into and the forms that emerged out of it, that is, human and land forms. And it, people talk about it in just ordinary language, that is, I can't help but think of my country, right? It can't help think of me. When I go, it does this. When I'm not, it does that, right? And this cultivated a form of perception that focused on the nuance of human and what we would call geographical interaction. There was a certain mindfulness. Why did that cloud go up? Why was it harder to find crab today? Why did a creek bed shift? And over time, I mean, to really cut the story short, over time, from the 50s to the 70s, as they were engaged in this analysis, and they were practicing, they thought, okay, well, what we'll do to intensify this project, we'll take our kids in ritual, we'll submerge them in certain water holes that will hurry the process along. And, in fact, they thought, right, it's working. Increasingly, all the signs were that this obligation was forming between a bio and geography. And again, not a traditional practice, a theory and an analytics. But this geontological analysis met a form of governance, and that's what's really important all through this talk. All these things are always already in the world. You can't have them anywhere else. And the form of governance that this geontology as an analytics of survival met was, in fact, that same 1970s liberal multiculturalism. We recognize the TO, the traditional owner. You have to have these kinds of characteristics to be a traditional owner. And one of the things you have to have is to be a clan. And another thing you really have to have is the appearance, at least, of a non-historical form of being. The more they showed that they were analyzing their life, the more they punctured the possibility of people imagining them as traditional, i.e. not historical people. Right? So the more they were really proud of what they had done, turning dislocation into location, the more the law looked at them and said, well, I'm sorry, then you're not from here. You don't get this place. And in the 80s, a land claim happened. And indeed, this experiment that was working as a form of life for this group of people failed as a form of life that would work for the law. As a result, only certain people within the community were given the status of a TO or traditional owner. And over time, things that we see all over Australia happened, which is the community split in two and new forms of violence emerged. So that in 2005, as I began a discussion about what to do with what was then now a huge archive that I had accumulated over, at that time, about 23 years, I think. By 2007, a riot had happened, and the members of the Kadabing left this community and tried to go back to what was now a pristine landscape in Anson Bay. But as they attempted to go back to the pristine landscape in Anson Bay, and the government said, you know, that's fine, you're traditional from there, we'll put some infrastructure in, something else happened. That is, late liberalism turned from recognition to a certain kind of denunciation of the cultural difference. And we see this all over when Sarkozy, Cameron, Merkel, all denounced multiculturalism as a failed political project. Same thing was happening in Australia in 2007. As a result, the government, a neoliberal government, and there was a report, it was a sex panic I can talk about later, but a sex panic prompted all this. And the government withdrew any funding from what they called the bush, and they said anyone who wants to live on their traditional lands has to fund that life vis-a-vis market principles. So if you wanted to live, that was fine, but like all other people, you had to make your life through a market. At the same time, police presence in communities escalated, and a whole other bunch of factors that are summarized a little bit here. In short, like Chipel, the river, Gigi is an effect of a complex of relations that are appearing right now at the intersection of late liberalism and something that we might be viewing as a certain end to late liberalism. If Gigi wants to keep her parents' and grandparents' genealogy alive, if she wants to make it work, she has to make it work in the world in which the solution to social inequity and poverty is a neoliberal solution, i.e. a market solution. She has to do it at a time when culture itself, vis-a-vis the sex panic, is considered perhaps salacious. And we can think, who better than Chipel, a kind of transgender creak, to be the object of our transmedia project. And we'll find that she has to, I think, put Chipel and put these places ahead, perhaps, of not only her life, but her children's life, the nation, the Australian nation, and the human itself as a, in its specific form of life, that is late liberal capital. Will Steffen, I thought, really got this point exactly. That is, if Gigi wants to keep Chipel alive, and through Chipel this other social imaginary, pull it into existence now, she's got to do it. When on the one hand, and this is what Steffen I thought was really great, half the world, we quote, want to pull half the world that's in poverty out of poverty and into our bucket. And if she's going to keep this alive, and this is, I'm turning to the last figure, if she's going to then keep this alive, this Chipel alive, she herself depends on a third woman, Julia Gillard. And the state, in some ways, and not state, but I want to get all these elements in, the state in which Chipel and Gigi also rest. Gillard's really interesting. You should go on YouTube. She this anti, this screed about misogyny. That's really great. I can't even do it. It's in itself is fascinating. Anyways, Gillard came into office in the wake of the intervention. That is, this in 2007 when the Australian government said, we're going to have an intervention. We're going to take away land rights. We're going to say anybody who wants to live in the bush has to go through the market. She came into office after the previous Conservative government who put the intervention, this intervention in Indigenous life, into place. But she also said that she was going to keep it in place. So she's a Labour minister replacing a Conservative government, but she did not overturn what many people saw as this draconian neoliberal form of the governance of difference. The new Labour government was first led by this guy, Kevin Rudd, and she, like, gave him a chop. And at the same time said, well, I'm going to keep everything in place. So if we want to capacitate our transmedia project, Gigi wants to keep Chipel alive and through Chipel keep Ruby and Roy alive, she and we are going to have to do so in the marketplace of ideas and the marketplace that Julia Gillard is forming, and also the climate sciences that are being developed in Australia now that we've heard more about. But the condition of life, remember, the condition of life we want to keep in place has also been demonized. Like, you know, Indigenous culture is just a sexual culture. That's kind of in the public imaginary right now. Thus, the neoliberalization of culture depends on a neoliberal market. Even if we could do something about the intervention, we still face the problem of financial capital. So in 2007, the government intervened. It said it's withdrawing funding. If you want to fund your projects, you have to do through the market. Remember in 2007 to 2008 what happened, which was a financial crisis, in which capital that had been lined up to potentially fund this project said, look, if you guys can't come up with a commodity that can we can capitalize on fairly immediately, we're withdrawing all our philanthropy and our philanthropic work. So funding dried up. Moreover, Australia is a really interesting place to think about the Anthropocene project, because anthropology and our transmedia project in the Anthropocene, because Australia seems to have weathered the capital crisis with more resilience than many other countries, and they have done so because of one market in particular, that is mineral extraction. By 2012, a quarter of Australia's exports, or 5% of its GDP, went to China. And 60% of the shipments that went to China, part of this export, were a single commodity, iron ore. The Australian dollar has increased in value because of the buoy of the mining sector, which has stifled other export and import industries. Tourism, for example, the very thing that our transmedia project might want to take advantage of, which made the nation's growth even more dependent on mining and gas extraction, and made mining magnates such as Gina Rinehart major influences on policy and public opinion. And as I alluded before, one of the ways in which the Qatarbing are going to try and fund at least the beginning of this project is through the desires of capital. That is, the Qatarbing engaged with the Northern Land Council, which had initially these councils had been created to fight for land, but now are really capital-creating mechanisms. The Qatarbing partnered with the Northern Land Council to hire a helicopter so they could decide where to drill for gas on their land. The Qatarbing thought that if they managed this correctly, just did it in small little places, it might provide funds to build the minimal infrastructure for their project. And it's all so very interesting and complex. So the Northern Land Council was, again, for those of you who know Australian stuff, Australia was colonized on the basis of this concept called terra nullius, empty land. Right? And then the land councils fought against this idea. Right? The whole activism, indigenous activism, was fighting against terra nullius. Now the Northern Land Councils need terra nullius. They need this empty landscape in order to allow mining to happen so that it can fund indigenous projects. And indeed, this trip in the helicopter sits in the vast shadow of mining in Australia that feeds the voracious appetite of Chinese manufacturing and is said to be responsible for Australia's miraculous weathering of the financial crisis. So we scuttle around. Right? Which way do we go? And I also note that, of course, these smart tablets that would play our transmedia project, right, rely on the iron ore we are or not digging out of the earth. What are the responses that we have to this project, to this dilemma? Are we simply going to move around capital, claiming that what closes capital in one corner might free it in another, such as the emergence of carbon credits and carbon trading as a way of solving the effects of coal-based production? Or are we going to say a project such as ours, this transmedia project that's so green, right, that it claims to reduce the carbon imprint through this virtual media? And yet, insofar as we rely on the material technology subtending our transmedia project, we're also relying on the same minds, if not in their country, someone else's, to produce the smart tablets that would power the Qatarbing's living library. That is, we are part of the search, Qatarbing. And I should say I'm a member of Qatarbing. We're part of the search for rare earths, which will power the clean smart devices that will run our project. A search increasingly digging into the ocean floor, altering the currents that will twist Chipil's legs and rot her wallaby. Thus, when Qatarbing seeks to find a way of capacitating this form of being life that is yet in existence, they, like their parents and grandparents, encounter a world of stubborn facts. How far are we going to actually go up to Chipil before we stop mining? If we say she matters more than Gigi's kids and her grandkids, attempt to pull themselves out of poverty. Won't this seem monstrous? Won't it seem inhuman? If we say a creek, which is a geotic form of life, has an ethical claim on existence that is equal to biotic forms, doesn't that seem obscene? Thank you.